I'd like to just quickly introduce myself as the Data Analytics Strategy Coordinator for the Activision Institute. My name is Marcus Sheila-Burton, and I'd like to extend a warm welcome to you and thank you for coming to this insight session. This is the first of a series of, there'll be a few more during the year with a data analytics theme. And I won't spend too much time up here. I'll do a really quick introduction and then get into the exciting business of analytics. So I'd like to welcome Leon Yan and Ziming Yu, who've come from Covermore, put together this presentation, which is quite technical in some ways, and there is an opportunity perhaps to ask questions as we go along. I'd just like to ask if you do have a question and you want to raise your hand during the session, we'll bring a microphone to you. And part of the reason for that is we have a lot of people on webinar who are joining us. So welcome to you as well through the webinar virtually. And if you have a question via the webinar, please email webinar@actuaries.asn.au and we'll take your question and we'll hope to answer it towards the end. So I think that's about it from me. Look, thanks. Make yourselves comfortable and I'll invite Leon up to commence. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Thanks everyone for coming. It's such a great turnout and seeing everyone mingling and meeting old friends and colleagues. So thank you all. So Zeming and I, we work at Covermore Travel Insurance. It's a very interesting kind of place to work, and I think some of you'll find that throughout the presentation, though I've tried to redact some of the kind of sensitive bits. It's going to be a longish presentation, so I really do hope you guys, you know, kind of hang in there. Marcus alluded to the fact that it can get a little bit technical in some of the parts there. So I just wanted to say maybe, you know, you saw in the ad a reference to like Zeming and I having, you know, years and years of experience. I just wanted to caveat that I'm commencing on my data analytics journey and I've done so for around a year. Though we have worked in general insurance, I've worked in general insurance for 10 years and I think same as Zeming. So something that I'm kind of interested and curious about, if I could just get a show of hands. So the question that I wanted to ask was, who has been using Python or maybe say in the last year or started using in the last year? If we could kind of raise our hands. And then what about in the last 2 years? Or 3 years? Yep, okay. So see, that's really interesting for me because I've just personally noticed that there's just an immense cacophony of noise around and very a sense of community around data science and data. And just especially this year, looking at the meetups that my colleagues are attending, a lot of interesting topics coming through, and which is especially relevant for us actuaries. Are there any data scientists in the room? Okay, yep. So we're mostly actuaries, and I think we need to be really interested about you know, all the cutting edge techniques and things like that. It's always good to just add another kind of skill set to our tool bag. So my day-to-day task is around valuations, understanding claims experience. I've had more and more opportunities now to dabble in data analytics. Zeming does a lot of predictive modeling. He's into kind of machine learning algorithms, and I'll share more so about what we're doing throughout the presentation. So I just wanted to set today's pace, okay? So it's going to be an hour and a half long. I'm glad you've all had your sandwiches. You've got kind of high energy levels. I will just allude to what you will see in the next 90 minutes. I want to talk about my own personal experiences and what I felt on my journey. So this is my part about it's okay to feel, and you'll know kind of how I felt throughout that journey. The next part, theoretical case studies. This is kind of like watching a cooking show and then someone brings out a cake. So I want to show you something that I've prepared earlier. And it's going to be, you know, quite interesting. Wanted to ask you a question, like, you know, is there anyone who's kind of been to the airport recently and who's kind of flown but been delayed by their flights? Who here thinks that Saturday mornings is the worst time to fly? Saturday mornings, right? You got a lot of kind of families heading out for the weekend or, yeah? So stay tuned for that. And then the next thing I wanted to talk about was, you know, betting odds. That's something quite interesting for us at work, believe it or not. We had a colleague who was into trying to arbitrage 40-20 those exotic betting options for rugby league matches. I think they closed that down, so he wasn't able to make any more money after that. I got into betting odds for a little bit because Unibet offered me a free Parramatta Eels jersey, which I thought was great, but that's in the closet now, based on how they're doing this year. The difficulty here is kind of, the duration's kind of correlated with the level of difficulty, so it's going to get a little bit more intense as we get our hands dirty and actually look at how we go about collecting data. So this is what I'm basically alluding to. It's going to be a little bit of a roller coaster, right? So we're kind of here, and you're going to feel really good as we go through the scenarios that I've concocted. Once we talk about in real life, which Zemi will share about how to get Meetup data, which is that great website where we go to find out interesting events with like-minded people, it's going to get pretty hard. So yeah, please hang in there. And there's going to be, well, a little intermission, fake intermission. I'm going to, if you want to get up, have a stretch, do that, because it'll kind of wake you up. Zem said I did fall asleep in my own presentation at a few times. So. All right. So my own journey. So I used to always use SAS to do my data processing. And I think SAS is synonymous with data processing in general insurance. I know in life insurance, there are different tools as well. And I complemented SAS with Excel. And then more recently, I'd say over a year ago, Zeming introduced Tableau into our work. And we saw how great it was as a tool to kind of slice and dice. I didn't have a need to use R. Then an interesting problem happened at work. I was trying to get my valuations to be more accurate, and I needed a travel insurance earning pattern. So if you've not worked in travel insurance before, but I'm assuming everyone here knows what an earning pattern is, interesting thing about travel insurance is that the policies, they're not all kind of 365 days long. You have people going on a one-month trip, people going on a six-month trip. They might buy in advance. So when they buy in advance, there's a lead time factor, so which means that the insurance company is up for the cancellation risk should an unforeseen event happen. When I think about that lead time factor, if you've organized the trip, you'll realize that the cancellation terms are usually quite stringent towards the day of departure. Well, that's because those third-party providers aren't able to resell tickets or whatnot. So things get more expensive closer to the trip. And obviously, when people cancel, that's a cost to the insurance company. So it's not like motor or home where you can just uniformly earn the premiums. So that was interesting for me. And I thought, well, I shared with Zeming how I did this. I did this in Excel. I sliced and diced in many different ways. And Zeming's like, no. How do you know these are the drivers of your earning pattern? How do you know, how to split up, trip length? How do you know what is a shorter trip and a longer trip? There's a great tool he said out there. It's called H2O. It's a package. It's a platform with an interface in R. And you could basically throw all these rating factors at it, and it'll tell you, and come up with a very predictive model. And from that point in time, I bought into that, and I thought, oh, great, because I'm going to be spending ages in Tableau slicing and dicing. I had my hypotheses as to what I needed to do, but I just wasn't sure how exactly to dissect my data. So around a year ago, that's what I did. I took the plunge, and I installed R on my PC. And what I found out subsequently was that I was kind of doing additional studies on the weekend because I just needed to complement what I was learning at work. So should I just say that, it's going to be a bit of hard work if you want to take that initial plunge. I must have had three or four different apps on my phone just reminding me these are the kind of things you need to remember in R and Python. I felt like I was learning Esperanto. It's similar but different. I don't know if you're familiar with Esperanto, but it's a kind of fictional language, and it's meant to be a very easy language that everyone can learn. Well, so they tell me about R and Python, but I've got all those apps on my phone. So I'll just tell you a little bit more about those, how I felt, but I'll go through it rather quickly. I did get a bit of a shock initially because I'm looking at all these terminologies in R, and I'm thinking, what do they all mean? So I was kind of like this man here, And I think in his slide, you'll see that there's a lot of package names and, you know, things like ggplot, things like, you know, dplyr and things like that, things in R, right? And he made the comment that people didn't know what they were and they sounded more like Pokemon names, which I thought was hilarious because I had the exact same feeling. And this is kind of based on the five stages of grief, okay? So I went through a period of denial where I thought I was the problem. But what happened was our company gave us a proxy server in order for me to connect to the outside world and download what I needed. They didn't tell me that it was subsequently blocked. So there I was trying for around an hour and a half or 2 hours, trying to figure out exactly what went wrong. But thinking that it was me, no, it wasn't me. So sometimes it could be the packages that are just not right. So you just need to find a way of kind of working through all of that. So I can't say that I was too angry or depressed, but there were times when I wasn't getting bang for buck. I was spending hours and hours trying to learn the languages, but I wasn't getting the same level of return. So I think my advice is just kind of hang in there because it will get better eventually. And where it got better for me eventually was when I found the community there on the internet, because people were having the same problems as I was, and all I needed to do was Google an answer. So the great thing with all these open source tools is the fact that there is a existing community out there, and there are massive online courses dedicated to, you know, helping you get there. So I just wanted to kind of leave it at that because you know, everyone's kind of different on their journey, and I don't want to bombard you too much with about how I'm feeling, because it's important, you know, where you get to in your next milestone. So just very quickly, some tips that I've learned from my colleagues. So just get your hands dirty. It's the only way to do it. Zeming will give you a very cool analogy about what it means to get your hands dirty, something around driving a vehicle, but I'll let you talk about that. Be prepared to talk to your IT department and just ask them, you know, can you install these packages for me? I'm coming up with these errors. Can you just do it? Can you figure it out for me? We're not IT experts, and I found that I had to talk to my BI department and on my IT department as well. Choose a pet project. So in my scenario, that I had a real business problem that I wanted to solve. So I had my manager's buy-in to try these new tools because, you know, he knew exactly what I was talking about when I said, I can't do this in Excel. So we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of policies that for me to earn them out in all those columns, you can just imagine how complicated that would be. But if I could just push it through a program and it would give me a unique earning pattern for that unique policy, that's definitely a big win. I had multiple projects on at the same time. My advice is just try and build momentum, work on the same thing, because it's easier to, especially when this is all new, it's easier to focus on the one thing and then carry it day to day. When you jump on other projects and then come back to it, inevitably you will forget you know, key concepts and terms. And when I was looking at our programs that are that I wrote a year ago, there are things there that I can no longer remember. I think that's just a reality. I mentioned there are massive online, massively open online courses. So these are the tutorials that I'm talking about. Very often they come up with promotions as well to kind of get you in onto their platform. So for those who haven't, you know, tried any courses, so they're usually free, and at the end you can donate a bit of money. You get a certification, which basically is a validation of all the hard work that you've put in, and then they, you know, donate your money as well. So I think that's a good way of learning those skills. Or you can just download the mobile apps, and I carry them with me. When I forget something, I can open it up. Google's awesome. All the answers are up on Stack Overflow. So that's a fantastic website. I talk to many different colleagues to get their ideas. Well, I focus more on R at work, but my colleagues are using Python. So there's always a natural kind of sharing of ideas. And then lastly, you don't want to be the guy kind of pulling their hair on the weekend. Take a break. It is okay to take some time out. So I've kind of run very quickly through my own experiences. Hopefully that was okay for everyone. Here are some kind of interesting things that I want to go through now, okay? So this is a hypothetical. I want to know, when is the best time for me to get to an airport? So earlier I asked you guys, when do you think is a really kind of bad time to fly? You thought maybe it was Saturday. I thought Saturday as well, but my data suggested otherwise. This topic is about kind of data collection as well, being at the start of your journey. So I'll talk a little bit about, you know, where I got my data from without kind of revealing too much. After all, I'm in travel insurance and, you know, flight cancellation products is the kind of thing I think about as well. But BITRE, Bureau of Infrastructure, is a good place to get data. And there are interesting stats there. So, for example, I found out that, 17% of flights in the industry are delayed 15 minutes or longer. And I was wondering whether my own data can show me similar signals, okay? So what you're looking at is an output from Tableau. So I still use Tableau day to day. My workflow crosses between R and Tableau, I'd say. I use Tableau to establish my hypotheses. And when I get the results or the outputs from R, I put that into Tableau as well, just to see where I'm overfitting or underfitting. But I'll get to that a bit later. So what you're looking at down the column is the number of minutes of delay. And then on the right-hand side is the proportion of flights that have arrived on time. And you'll see that in my particular data set, around 89%, so that's the fourth row, 89% of flights are arriving within 15 minutes. So I thought, okay, this is kind of similar to the industry. But just having a look at the information there doesn't give me much comfort when it comes to kind of flying. You really need to, you know, buffer, plan in advance. Delays are actually very common, just like, you know, getting buses or trains. I saw an interesting article from yesterday about, you know, whether or not the 370 is the worst bus to catch. So there was one of the particular ladies mentioned in the article, she did her own data collecting and she presented something similar, but on the statistics of buses being late. Anyway, let's move along. What you'll see here is similar information, but instead of looking at it cumulatively, we're looking at for each particular delay along the x-axis, you know, what proportion of flights is that impacting? So this is showing the same information, albeit in a different way. So the reason I showed you the one before and this one is, you know, when you're presenting things at work, you just got to think about, you know, what's easier for your audience to read. Some people maybe like the actuaries, they like looking at it cumulatively. Some people like looking at it incrementally. Yeah, I just put both in there because that was something I came up against. People, for, you know, whatever reason, they didn't understand this, but when they looked at this, they go, ah, that all makes sense. So sometimes you just have to, make sure that it resonates with your audience. This one I find really interesting as well. Now, I don't have a legend there. Can you guys guess what that particular blue line is? It's kind of like a rhetorical question. I'm not expecting anyone to jump up down and go, aha. The blue line is a particular route, and that route is not so good when it comes to arriving at your destination on time, because there's less percentage of arrivals on time. That's actually getting in and out of Canberra, which I understand to be notorious for fog in certain times of the year. So I just found that really interesting because I saw the insight, but I didn't know really what was the driver of that. I did a bit more research, read a few more articles, and it turned out to be, you know, Canberra fog. So, you know, Tableau allows me to come up with a hypothesis. It also allows me to, find out what the drivers are and then do a bit more research. So when it comes to, information collection, you know, you will be jumping in between as well. So I asked you about days of the week. So you'll see Saturday, which is the yellow, which is similar to that orange, which is for Tuesday, is right at the top of all those lines. Saturday is actually a very good time to fly. I think what is happening is everyone's thinking, oh, look, Saturday is horrible. You're going to get all these families and kids and all, they're all flying out. There's going to be delays. You know, everyone is on their day off, so therefore I'm not going to book any flights there. So that's just one hypothesis. That might be wrong. But you'll see that the days that are not good, well, the one particular day that stands out there is Friday. And I think I've got a hypothesis for that as well. So you've got all these business travelers who are wanting to get home to their families for dinner. So Friday is pretty bad. And also Monday, which is the blue, which is the next worst day, I'd say. So Monday, again, business travelers, they're trying to get to work. That could be wrong, but that's just what I thought of. Let's look at the average delay by day, though. So we were looking at previously the percentage of flights that arrived on time. This is looking at how long are they delayed for. You'll see, again, Monday and Friday stands out. So I found that really interesting. Looking at the hour in the day where when you arrive at your destination, the darker colors are meaning later in the day. And what I found was that between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m., that's a really bad time for flying because, you know, there's a greater chance of being delayed. And the hypothesis, that I came up with was the fact that you have a cumulative effect, a stacking effect throughout the day. So all it takes is some flights to be delayed earlier in the day, and that's going to have a cumulative impact on all the flights later in the day. So, and what happens obviously when the day finishes is that everything resets, they go back to their schedule. So I thought, okay, this is, and when I was reading the Bitree website, there was a lot of, you know, similar information there. I found that to be quite a useful site personally. Okay, you see a lot of lines there. What does it all mean? So I've highlighted only three lines: 30-minute delay, 45-minute delay, 60 minutes delay. Okay, the line at the very, very top denotes the proportion of on-time arrivals with a delay of 60 minutes or less. That's the very top line. The very top line is a bit more stable. That's just because you have a longer window for, you know, of opportunity for the flights to arrive on time. So you have a more kind of stable outcome. But if you're asking or looking for flights that have arrived within 30 minutes, then obviously, you know, you'll get a more volatile outcome. So this is what the data is telling me. And then this one is looking at the scheduled time of arrival, but the average delay rather than the proportion of flights that have arrived on time. So again, you'll see that after 6 p.m., where there is a delay, on average, it will be longer. This one is looking at across the calendar year, and you'll see various spikes there. If you were to kind of take time to digest this, what you'll see is that it is actually very much in line and correlated with school holiday seasons, okay? You'll just have to trust me on that one. When's the best time to fly? So this is by month. So this is just at a more macro view, okay? This is when's the best time to, so looking at the number of flights that are delayed now, so not the proportion of flights that have arrived on time, nor the average delay, if there was one, but looking at the number of flights delayed. This is amazing. There's a sawtooth pattern. The same thing happens week in, week out. This one is looking at, by day, but each line is a day in the year. So there's actually 365 lines there. And, you know, this validates the sawtooth pattern. Basically, there's more delays on Friday. We know that the delays on Friday are actually longer as well. So the reason I showed you this was a little bit also about the power of Tableau that I found in my day-to-day workflow. I remember doing this in less than a day. And all I was doing was just slicing and dicing by all kinds of factors that I had in my data, not knowing where it would lead me. But I had that opportunity to do that. Imagine doing that in Excel, right? It's just not easy to do. And then again, if I was highly proficient in R, maybe I had some other tool or interface that I could do this in R by. So these were the hypotheses that I had at the very end. So number of flights in the day, where the flights are going to, day of the week, time of the day, and then lastly, you know, whether or not it's in and around school holiday time. I just wanted to touch on feature engineering. Feature engineering, you may or may not have heard of this term. It's basically you get your data set. how can you modify this data set to make it as predictive as possible? Now, the reason I'm showing this, all the yellow are stuff that I've derived from that existing data set. So the white columns are the stuff that I was given. So I wasn't given a lot of data, to be honest, which actually made it faster in Tableau to slice and dice. But all the yellow stuff was things that I came up with. And I'll tell you why I did that. So you know, what is feature engineering then? Well, you know, maybe it's all about adding on, you know, the season. You know, that's one way of feature engineering. I was given airport codes, so I could then, you know, put on their state. You know, so that's something which is very simple. And then if I go a little bit kind of deeper, this is putting on public holidays. This is putting on school holidays. And so, for example, you see there a column of numbers going from 6 to, say, 22. That's just me saying, is it the 6th day of the school holiday? Is it the 7th day? Is it all the way up to the 22nd day? This one was an interesting one because you know how I said there's a stacking effect to there being delays throughout the day? Well, how did I test or how did I find out the predictiveness of the stack of the number of flights in a day? Well, I had row by row flight data, and all I had to do was figure out how many flights were for that airport on that day or in that hour. So all these different you know, ways of thinking about the stacking effect is what you can feature engineer onto your data. So I put my data set into R, and then you know, I was kind of like at the start of my learning process as well. So I was still in a state of shock, you know, shock in a good way, because I realized that, hey, I could run a gradient boosting using, you know, a couple of lines of code, which is what I've highlighted there in yellow. This was a way of keeping track of all the iterations that I had done. So this was a point of frustration for me because I did so many different iterations. I just lost track of which one was the final model. And the great thing about H2O is that for that particular platform, you can try so many different methods just by changing one parameter or a few parameters. So again, I was back in Tableau. I took my results out of R, and then, so this was after I had scored the predictions onto the data that I had not seen. So when you do modeling, you set aside some data that you don't let the when you're trying to train your models, you don't want to see that data. And then what you do is you score the predictions onto that data set to see how well it predicts on the unseen data, because you did all the training on the trained data. So this showed me that, hey, my hypotheses were you know, okay, they were reasonable, because you know, I was able to predict. So if I go back to this one was predicting the number of delays. The number of daily delays. This one was looking at by route. So there were four different routes here. So am I predicting that well? This was looking at the day of the week. And so what I wanted was the orange and the red lines to be close. And this one was looking at the day, the hour in the day the flight is to schedule to arrive. So all of this got me to the very end, which is some kind of a rate card, right? What this is are the five factors put into a massive table. What was important for me were the colors. That's all I wanted to get, just to know how I could, at a macro level, think about, because where I wanted to get to was a flight cancellation product or flight delay kind of product. So this is just a hypothetical, but what that allows me to do is actually come up with frequencies and put that into a rate card of sorts. So the red is where there are more delays, longer delays, and I see kind of consistent patches there, and that's just the different drivers of the model coming through. Okay, so enough of that. Once you have a great idea, a hypothetical scenario, maybe it's time to kind of pitch that to the organization if you think it's got legs. Here's another example. So I wanted to know how spot on the betting public are when it comes to predicting, you know, winners and losers. You know, we've all heard about the collective wisdom of the crowd. So as an individual, you may not, you know, you might not be able to predict these kind of things, but if you take the average views of everyone, say everyone in this room, you get an average outcome, which is, you know, more or less right. So the reason I mention this, so recently, around a year ago, our company, Covermore, we signed a partnership with Arsenal. So this is like a sponsorship of sorts. So I was thinking, you know, just hypothetically speaking, you know, how's Arsenal doing? Are they winning or are they losing? You know, if they lose, you know, we're Covermore Travel Insurance. So could we offer some kind of commiseration to our travelers or fans of Arsenal? Or if Arsenal wins, could we somehow incorporate a prize or a benefit? I'll say that, I'll leave it at that. This is just hypotheticals. I don't think you can, don't expect anything in the space, actually. This is just my harebrained idea. So this relates to the other point, which was pick a pet project. Just pick something interesting, something to sink your teeth into that will help you along in the process. Okay, so if I wanted to find out about, you know, how accurate betting odds are, we went to Odds Portal to have a look at the betting odds on Arsenal matches, and I think I took this screenshot of the World Cup. Now, betting odds. So just to keep it brief, because I know a lot of people in the room understand betting odds as well, these are the payouts. So if I'm betting a dollar and Arsenal wins, I'll get $1.80 back, okay? You can get an implied probability of that outcome being true from the betting odds. All you do is take one inverse. So 1 divided by 1.8, you'll get 56%. That's the implied probability of Arsenal winning. If you add up all the mutually exclusive and exhaustive outcomes, you get 107%, not 100. So the 107 is because the bookmakers put a margin there. But anyway, what does that mean for me if I'm betting on Arsenal winning? If I perceive, and if I think I'm right, that Arsenal is only going to win 45% of the time or for that particular match, I don't want to bet. I don't want to, you know, bet a dollar on Arsenal winning and think that I might get $1.80 back. It's not going to be a good bet. Rather, I'd bet on the match being a draw or Arsenal losing because my perceived probabilities are greater than what the implied are. That's just, I'll leave it at that. This is what happened when we scraped all the data that you saw on the previous screen. It comes out looking all kind of funny CSV style in Excel. What did I do with that information? Well, I looked at having the betting odds was helpful because I also knew what was the actual outcome. So what I'm doing here is I'm comparing the actual outcome with the implied outcome. So there's a blue and a red. The blue means that the betting public thinks that there's a 55% chance of Arsenal winning. Actually, they won 59% of the time for that cohort of matches I looked at. I looked at a lot of matches. So from 2004 all the way up to 2017, and you'll see the red line is above that faint blue line. What does that tell me? Arsenal actually wins. Arsenal's actual winning percentage is better than what the market or what the betting market perceives what their perceived winning percentage is. So they do better than what the betting public is perceiving. So I think, hey, Arsenal is a good team to be betting on, on average. So this is two different types of matches. Maybe just a show of hands just to get everyone awake again, if they're not. So on the left-hand side is, you know, you have lower numbers than the right-hand side. Who thinks that the column on the left is representative of matches that they do not play at Emirates Stadium? They're not playing at home. I made that really complicated, sorry. They're playing away, not at home. Who thinks that's away games? Yeah, you're right. So they're away games, right? So don't underestimate the power of playing at home when you've got the crowd cheering behind your back. So Arsenal wins 68% of the time when they're playing at home, but only 50% of the time when they're playing away. And the betting public thinks that as well. And they're the blue numbers. They're the blue bars. Now, there's a solid line and a faint line. The solid line is, again, the actual winning percentage. So this is comparing matches played at home and matches played away. So when they're playing at home, they do win more games than when they're playing away, because the orange line is above the blue line. This is comparing the winning percentages by different tournaments. And you'll see that they play most of their games on the Premier League. You'll see my grey bars at the bottom. That's the exposure. That's the number of matches played. They play 64% of their matches in the Premier League, 17% of their matches in the Champions League, which will probably stay pretty low. And then the Europa League number will be kind of going up if they don't perform that well. So anyway, this is just interesting if you want to compare across tournaments and leagues. This is looking at, again, the different leagues. Is this an indication that they were not performing that well in the Champions League? Yeah, like I don't know. But what I'm saying is, if you're tracking the betting odds, you may get signals that you don't perhaps read elsewhere. This is looking at it by geography. So they play great on the world stage, and that's probably because they play friendlies. You know, they're playing against teams of a lesser caliber. And then lastly, I like this one because it's got goal difference along the bottom. So goal difference being how many goals Arsenal scores, less how many goals they concede. When it's positive, as in when it's towards the right-hand side, the betting public thinks that they have a high percentage of winning. So yeah, the betting public's doing all right. So this is the intermission where if you want to, you can get up and have a stretch. But hopefully I've showed you what that end product can look like once you've got all your data. So those were just kind of two hypotheticals that I came up with that I thought might be interesting for my work. So the next part of the presentation, I'm going to hand over to Zemi. So I'll do that quickly. I will just say that, you know, we decided to choose Meetup, the website Meetup, in order to collect data for our analysis. I'm a great fan of Meetup because I get to meet like-minded people within my industry. I meet data scientists, and you'll see from the screenshots here that I go to data science, I go to the R forum, I go to InsurTech. And for those who haven't signed up to Meetup, you can find a lot of interesting topics there, not necessarily work-related. So, you know, if you're an anime fan or you're into sports, there's going to be a Meetup there for you. So thank you very much for, thank you for having me share my scenarios with you. I hope that was interesting for everyone. I'll pass over now to Zemi.
Thanks, Leon. So now that Leon has showed you how the well-prepared food, how nice they look like, you know, I'm going to actually show you how you actually prepare the food. You need to pick a pet project, as Leon said. So if you can't think of anything, we recommend you pick Meetup as your pet project. I'll show you how to get the data, and I'll also show you how to do a bit of analysis. So the goal is for me to show you just enough so you can go home and download a notebook and follow along, and then just try it at home. That's the only way to learn. So before we get into Meetup data, so I want to introduce you to application programming interface. So just a show of hands, how many of you have heard of API before? Okay, looks like half of the people knows. So API is actually everywhere. It's kind of like the interface where for different applications to talk to each other. So in this case, how many of us are using TripView to check train timetable? Okay, so most of people are using TripView. It's very popular here in Australia. So the data is actually coming from a data feed from Open Data. So in theory, you could actually build your own app based on the data feed. So just another example of API. So Gmail has an API. You can control Gmail. You can write a program to send emails or do things. And another example, how many of us know about Scikit-learn? Okay, so not many. So Scikit-learn is a machine learning framework in Python. So in R, you have lots of frameworks, but in Python, the main framework is Scikit-learn. It's got, you know, your regression, your gradient boosting machine, all sorts of machine learning packages. So API, in this case, just it's kind of like the documentation. So it tells you what you need to do to run these models. So what kind of function you need to call, what parameters you need to supply. So all of that is written in the API reference. And another example, TensorFlow. So how many of you know about TensorFlow? Okay, so not many. So TensorFlow is probably one of the best deep learning packages created by Google. So it's used everywhere in terms of analytics on based on neural networks. So finally we have our Meetup API. So if you just Google Meetup API, you get to this page. This page gives you all the detail about the documentations and how you get access to it. So to get started, the first thing is to create a Meetup account. So if you don't have an account, you won't be able to use the API. You might be able to do web scraping, but that's not a recommended approach. It's much easier with an API. It's also much nicer. So if you go to the API web page and get to the API key, so you'll see your own API key. So I won't be sharing my API key for you to spam the website. I think there's a rate limit, so you might be able to, I think, do 200 queries or something for over an hour, and then you start all over again in the next hour. This is to make sure you don't bring down the website. So if you go to API console page, you can get a feel of what kind of data is there. So in this instance, we're doing a search for groups within Australia. So you can see the first box says Australia. And then second box says if there's an upcoming event or not. It's a true or false. Groups within Australia with an upcoming event. And then finally, with the word actuarial in the description. So we're looking for actuarial meetup groups. So once you run that, you'll see the data on the left-hand side. And if you go to the name of the group is called Actuarial Social Networking Group. I think a number of us might have been there. It's a casual drinking session and you just do some networking. If you go to the website, you see right-hand side, you can see the descriptions, you see the number of members, 250 people. So all that data is actually inside the API data feed as well. So when you do any analysis, it will be good to have a look at the raw data at the most fundamental level, what they look like, and validate that against the web page in this case. And you can get more details like upcoming events, the date and the description of the event. So this is the Melbourne end of financial year drinks. So we've gone through all this and we're now comfortable that the API data is giving us, the data feed is giving us the right kind of data. So next I want to introduce the concept of JSON. So JavaScript Object Notation. As actuaries, we're very familiar with structured data sets like CSV, you know, your SAS tables, right? So you have your rows and columns are nicely put together. But in the modern technology world, actually there's a different data format called JSON. It's a plain text format. It's kind of the de facto format for web and mobile applications. So when you're sending data, and say sending from your server to your browser, you're probably sending a JSON file. And it's very flexible. So you'll see that it's able to represent almost any kind of data structure. So it doesn't have to be, you know, one row per policy or something. You can have nesting, you can have, yeah, very powerful, very flexible. It's supported by most modern programming languages, including Python, which is what we're gonna use today. So here's the same API data we got from Meetup. You'll see, you know, I've just put into my text editor. So you kind of see there's a curly bracket at the top, and there's some structure going on, and there's a 0, 1. So at the fundamental level, inside JSON, it's pretty much a key value pair. So for example, here we've got name being the key, and value is the social networking actuarial group. So just a lot of key value pairs. So another example, the key is the URL name and value is the actuarial social networking group. So that's the string that you put into your web browser to get to the page. So also we can do nesting. So here you'll see the keys being 0, 1, 2. What it means is you got a whole JSON structure nested inside the big JSON file. So 0 might be for a particular group and 1 might be for a different group. So you can have any kind of nesting. So by the way, please ask questions if you have any. This is designed to be very interactive. So yeah. So any questions at this stage? No, so I'll just keep going. So now we have had a play with the data in the Meetup webpage. I just want to show you PowerShell. So PowerShell is the scripting language that you can use in Windows. So currently, you know, we have a lot of manual process at Covermore. For example, run a particular SAS program, look at the log, look at the listing file, find out the errors, you know, do some manual reconciliation, and paste this data into the CSV, the Excel, refresh pivot table. I'm sure many of us will be familiar with this kind of workflow. Our goal is actually to automate a lot of it, so make our life much easier, and we can focus on value-adding tasks rather than repetitively doing the same thing again and again. So PowerShell is really useful because we can use it to control SAS programs. We can use it to write data into spreadsheets, copy files across, basically all sorts of things. So this is just a quick example of what you can do in PowerShell. So first, so the goal is to pull down the API JSON file using PowerShell, right? So at the top we got URL. So we define the string. You see the red bit is the API key, which I won't be sharing with you. Next, you got a series of commands. So you see the vertical line. It's called pipe, right? So the concept is you have a lot of little tasks, and you're feeding the output of one task as an input to the next task. So you keep on doing that, eventually you can accomplish something quite significant. So here, the first thing we do is invoke web request. It's just downloading, it's getting data from the URL. And then next, we're converting that into a JSON file. Next, we're formatting a table, selecting only three columns. And finally, we're saving the output to a text file. So you can see we're doing four different tasks, and we can do that within the same line of code. So next part is Jupyter Notebook demonstration. So again, just to clarify, it's quite content heavy. It's quite hard to understand 100%. The goal is to give you a taste, so you can go home and download it and have a play. So the meetup data, it's all public. So the stuff that Leon showed you, a lot of it is sensitive, so you won't be able to try it at home. But the data, what I'm doing here is all public. You go home and try it and have a play. And that's the best way to learn. And we'll be publishing the notebook on the Actuarial Digital. So we've got a series called Analytics Snippet. So it's currently, I think Jackie Poon has written an article about analyzing library data. So we'll be publishing more stuff there. So it's all designed to be hands-on and just to encourage you to try it. So this is the Jupyter Notebook. So how many of you know about Jupyter Notebook? Okay, cool. So about a third of people. So there's actually a movement called notebook, a concept called notebook, right? So the idea is that you got your codes, you got your output, and you got your documentation all in one place. So it's about doing reproducible research. So when you do some analysis, you can just hand over the notebook to your colleague, and they'll be able to follow along. And they'll see exactly what's happening. So in Python, the notebook is called Jupyter. So you see, for example, the headings here, all these fonts, this styling, they're all done in code. So once you have the Jupyter notebook, you can see how I wrote the markdown, how I wrote the notes inside the notebook. All right, so in the next 40 minutes or so, we'll be going through three parts. Part one, we'll show you how to get the meetup data using the API. And part two, we'll show you a bit, once you get the data, what can you do with it? What Python package can you use to manipulate the data and do some analysis? And finally, we'll show you how to do web scraping. So for example, the betting odds, if you want to make some money, try your luck with with the 40-20 or Arsenal games, because Leon has identified that there's an opportunity to make some money. So you want to try that, you could go home and start to scrape some data, but we bear no responsibility for you bringing down any websites. Yeah, it's kind of dangerous, kind of like showing you how to use a gun. So we have to we have to be responsible. All right, so first let's go through how to get the data from the Meetup API. So I reckon don't read the notes, because there's quite a lot of stuff. So just focus on the code, and I'll be explaining the code. So first, we have to import the packages. So the beauty about open source platform is you got so many people keep on building different packages, right? And they can share that with you without charging you a fee. So if you use a proprietary software, you have to wait for the next update, you have to pay more money and keep on going. Whereas with open source, anyone can publish contents and you can use it. So here we're importing three packages. So requests is the package to talk to your web browser to get data from the API. So and then you got pandas. Pandas is the main data manipulation package. So if you're familiar with SAS, it's kind of the equivalent of base SAS, your data steps. Finally, we've got time. So time, we just use here to pause for a few seconds so that we're not hammering the website too much. So yeah, first thing, you gotta set up your API key. So go to that page and download your own API key. All right, so to talk to the API, we need to work out what parameters to supply. So remember, I was showing you in the API console, you can type in Australia, you type in the keyword being actuarial. So what do we actually do here? By the way, we're getting a list of members. So we're doing a different API call now. We'll get all the members for this actuarial meetup group. So first, we define the group name. So meetup group is equal to the string. Second, we got offset. So typically, there's a lot of data, right? You don't want to supply a API call and then pull down a million rows. So that's not practical. So you have this concept called offset. So you're kind of doing it in batches. So you pull down 200 rows, and then you move offset to one, and you pull down another 200, and you keep on going. So yeah, that's offset. All right, so before we go further, I want to show you two key data structures in Python. So it's called dictionary and list. So dictionary is just a lot of key value pairs. So does that sound familiar? Key value? Yeah, so the same concept as JSON. So you can have key being B, value being beauty. So key being J, value being joy. So a lot of key value mappings. And the second structure is called lists. So in lists, there's no keys, just a lot of values. But you have index, so indices. So you start from 0, so 0, 1, 2, keep going. In Python, you start from 0. In R, you start from 1. So just bear that in mind. So when I was using Python, I had some trouble because I thought the first element was 1. All right, so now we know what dictionary is, right? So we're creating a parameter dictionary. So we're supplying all the the URL name, the KPI key, the offset. So that's, and put that together into a Python dictionary. And next we call the requests package. So we call the get function within the request package. And we're saying, hey, hello Meetup API, can you give me some data? And here's my instructions. So just go into my parameters dictionary, and you'll know what I'm ordering. So if you run that, you get response 200, which means okay, right? So that's actually a standard HTTP status. So how many of you have seen 404, request 404? Yeah. So 404 means error. So we run that, and then we store that in a different variable called the request. And next, we convert that into a JSON object, and then we can start to pull different elements out of the JSON object. So for example, we can get the rest results part of the object. And then we can get the very first element, which has the index 0, right? So the square bracket 0 means get the first element. So actually we got this person called Yanni. So is Yanni here today? No. So okay, we're gonna look at the second person, Alia. Is Alia here? No, okay. So we can also see how many members there are, right? So do a len function, you get 200 elements. And then you can go straight to the very last element. So in Python, you can use -1. So that's very convenient, right? You can go straight to the last element without knowing how many elements there are. So the last person is Rebecca, and yeah, she's got a lot of interests. You see, wine and food, crafts, language, education. So later on, we'll show you some analysis we can do on this interest group, because there's actually some commercial application if you think about it. Yeah, so I'm just showing you, you can actually call element 199, and that gives you the same result as negative 1. So we still have Rebecca here. All right, so now that we know how to pull the members, I want to go back and then just run the example of pulling down group data. So again, you know, we're creating a Python dictionary, just telling Python, you know, what do we need, right? We need country, we need city, and we need a text, so actuarial, and we need a group with some upcoming events. So once we got all the parameters, we do the same thing, right? So call the get function, and then call the .json function to create a JSON object. Then we can go into the data again. So you see that there's only a single group matching this criteria. So which says that, you know, probably the actuarial profession is not very active in the meetup space. So yeah, this is a group. And by the way, it's actually, I think it's created by our boss, Bill. So that's why we're promoting it. Just joking. So yeah, you can have a look. You know, so the goal, you know, description, all the data. You can get photo URLs. You know, all the photos you see, you can actually go directly to the source and pull down the photo. So for example, You might want to create your own mobile applications, right? Your Android app for Meetup. You can do that with this API. So it's very powerful. And another example is say Covermore Insurance. So we have our own rating engine. So if we open up the API for the rating engine, potentially you can build your own front end and start selling travel insurance. So it allows a lot of parties to work with each other. So yeah, just you can also get a description by calling that. So yeah, so I've showed you how to get some data, bits and pieces of the data. I want to show you how to create a structured data set, right? So that you can start doing the analysis that Leon talked about, you know, visualization, the modeling. So to do that, you need to understand a function. So a function is just a kind of routine or macro which does a specific task. So in Python, you need a keyword called def, so definition, def. And then you create a function name, and then you have an input parameter. So in this case, we're creating a function to convert temperature from Fahrenheit to Celsius. So just taking the temperature in Fahrenheit, and then we return, right? We do the calculation and return the value. So this is the formula for that. So why do we use function? In programming, there's a concept called don't repeat yourself. So if you find yourself writing a piece of code and copy and paste that 10, 20 times, you're probably not doing that correctly. What you should do is put into a function, and then you call that function repetitively. So here we put together a function where we're getting the data using our request package and converting that result into a JSON object, and then return the JSON object. That's the purpose of this function. All right, so next we're gonna create a data set using this function. So yeah, we're creating empty list, so called members. We're using the members list to store the results, and then you'll see how quickly you can create a structured data set using that. So to do that, we need a loop, right? So you're not going to manually do that 100 times. We have a loop. So you see, while true, it's actually an infinite loop, but it's made finite by calling this break keyword. So it's just saying, okay, keep on pulling the data until you have less than 200 rows from the result, and at that step you exit. So because you're doing 200 rows of data at a time, and when you get to say 250, that's your last batch, and then that's when you finish. So in this case, we only have 262 members. So at this step, we got a list of members, list of JSON objects. We want to create a data set. So it's actually extremely convenient, right? We just call pandas.dataframe. So this single step allows you to convert the result into a nicely structured data set. To view it, we want to show the full column. So if you don't do that, you see some of the columns being squeezed in. So that's why we call this set option step. All right. So once we've done that, we now have a data set, right? So you can have a look. So we've got a city, so where the member is from, in the country, the hometown, the member ID, the latitude and longitude. So we got quite a lot of detail there. So, all right. So next, we want to do the same thing for data science Sydney. Just to see, what's the community like in data scientists. So effectively, I'm doing the exact same thing. I'm just changing the meetup group to data science Sydney. So you will see, this is the first member of Data Science Sydney. And then, again, we call it the Pandas data frame, pandas.dataframe to get the data set. All right, so now we have two data sets. So actuaries and data scientists. So next, I want just to compare the membership size, right? So I called dot shape to look at how many rows and columns there are. So you will see, actually this data scientist community is much, much bigger. You've got close to 5,000 members there. In the actuaries communities, only 200 something. But if more of us join, then we'll be helping with this competition. So next step, I want to put the data sets together and just to see who is in both groups. So how do I do that? I create a column called group, because once I mix them together, I won't be able to tell who's in which group. So I create a group variable. So just put actuaries or data scientists in the group variable. And then I use the concatenation function to put them together. So kind of stacking the data sets vertically together. So I can check that I've got the right number of members after combining them. So and I can call the dot value counts. So that's equivalent to the proc summary if you're using SAS. We have the right number of members. And then we do dot duplicated, right? We can see how many people are in both groups. We see 21 people, and actually, and who they are, we can actually see our boss is there. and then I think Dimitri is our boss son. Yeah, I think Sasha's here, still here today. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Bill is promoting, data science, so actuarial career to his sons. So we got quite a few familiar faces. Also, I think Michael So Michael is our colleague. Yeah, Michael. So he's in the data analytics working group as well. So yeah, you can actually try all of this at home and just feel free to explore. So we can also see the data structure, you know, which columns are kind of strings, which columns are numeric. So in Python, object means a string. So we've also got integer and floating numbers. All right, so that's part one. And part two, we're gonna, you know, once we have this data, what can you do, right? So that's the key question. So in your own organization, if you have some data, you know, one thing is to do it for fun. The other thing is, how do we bring commercial value to your organization and get more buy-in, right? So one thing you can do is something called market basket analysis. So it comes from kind of the retail industry. You see certain people buy things together, you know, like buying beer and chips together, or say a family, they might buy nappies and, you know, baby stuff together. So there's some patterns there. So this analysis is about how do you uncover the patterns. So, you know, we got these interest groups from Meetup, right? How do we see which interest groups go together? So we got this, you know, this one line of code. Sorry, to do that, we need to do some data manipulation. So you can look up later, you know, what's lambda and what's list comprehension. But effectively, with one row of code, you can convert, you know, this complex data structure into something a bit nicer, right? So you know, we want just a list of interests. We don't want the rubbish like, you know, ID code or other stuff, URL key. So how do you do that? Just run that line of code. So yeah, I think Python's pretty powerful. You know, just think of how you would do that in your, you know, your SQL, your other languages. How do you do that? Just to confirm, you know, we still got this one row per person data set. So remember Yanni and Aliyah, right? You'll see Actuary Institute is also a member as well. And Actuary Institute is very interesting actuarial matters. So yeah, like actuarial exams and science and all that stuff. So yes, so to do the market basket analysis, we need to create a file with a lot of dummy columns. So one row per column, just a yes, no. So that's the line of code to do that. You can research at home. So for example, I might have three interests. So drinking, laughing. Is that an interest? I'm not sure. Why is laughing interest? Yes. So basically, you just have a one there, and then everything else will be zero. So that's the data structure. So run that on the full data set, and then we can again leverage the open source community to run some modeling. So to discuss that, we need to just want to show you the some concepts. So there's three metrics that we look at. Support is how frequent some combination is. So for example, we got 8 transactions here. 4 of them include an apple. So 4 out of 8. So we got 50% support. Just basically tells you how popular something is. And next we got confidence. Confidence is a bit like conditional probability. So given you've bought apple, what's the likelihood that you're going to buy beer as well? So I think in this case, it's a 3 out of 4. Yeah, 75%. And finally, we got lift. So lift is also, so lift is like confidence, right? Except we're also allowing for how popular the other item is. So how popular beer is. So basically, the interpretation is that given you've bought something, how likely are you to buy something else? So the commercial application is that you can do some recommendation system, right? So you bought A and B, we can recommend C to you, and then you can you can maximize your revenue that way. So I think a very significant chunk of Amazon's revenue comes from the recommendation engine. So yeah, we ran the analysis on the meetup interest groups, and so basically just calling a couple of functions, and then we can see the result by descending order. So you see, what kind of things go together, right? We've got data visualization and predictive analytics. That makes sense. You see, Leon has, before he built a model, he was using Tableau to visualize the data. So they definitely go together. And next, you got big data, data analytics, and data mining. So you see, kind of clusters of interests, right? So it's not just, you're just interested in one aspect. There's a lot of different niches, but you kind of get to learn all of them together. So yes, so you see they have very high lift, so 6 or above 6. And if you look at look down the list, you see things that are not so associated, like startup business and data analytics. So they don't have such a strong association. So that's it for meetup data. So finally, we'll show you how to do web scraping if you want to start your own pet project on anything, right? On any websites, you can use web scraping. So just a few notes. This is a gray area. So if you look at the, on every website, there's something called robots.txt. So just type in website link /robots.txt. You will see the rules for web scraping. Pretty much every website says they pretty much forbid you from web scraping. So, however, I think that's the standard. But however, in reality, there's definitely a lot of web scraping happening. So that's why it's a bit of gray area. It should be the last result. If there's an API, I recommend you to use the API. It's just saying, hey, it's me. I'm your user. I'll follow your rules and please give me some data. Don't harm the website, so don't bring it down and slow down the process. Rather than repetitively hammer the website, why don't you put a bit of break there? Because often, I think some of the amateur web scrapers could bring down websites. The professionals, how to do that slowly, and do it during non-business hours, so like 2 a.m. or something. That's why we see traffic peaks at our websites at 2 a.m. All right. So basically, yes, do that, but. Yeah, we bear no responsibility for what you did. All right, so how do you do that, right? So you call this package called Beautiful Soup. That's the main package in Python. And you create your own link variable, and you can do request.get as we discussed. So you put on the web page, and then you use Beautiful Soup to convert that to something a bit easier to follow. And then you can look for keywords. So for example, in this case, I was searching for a post list item. You might wonder, how do I know which item to look for? Actually, in your browser, if you right click and you go inspect element, you will see the element in your web page, and you just see it. It's just a trial and error thing. So see if you can pull the right element using that. So yeah, we've got a bunch of data here. We can. So by the way, this is an example using the actual digital, because I figure I won't get into trouble by presenting the actual institute by using institute's website. Hopefully, I'm okay. So yeah, we're looking for a header, right? So H2 is the header, and we can do dot text to pull out the name of the article. So yes, the article name, President's Report to Members. So that's our article. We can also pull the links. So yeah, just do dot attributes, A-T-T-I-S, href, you can pull down the link to the article. And you can do dot text again to pull the pull down the dates. And again, same kind of stuff. We're creating a bunch of empty lists, and we're using a for loop to convert all the data and put them into a nicely formatted data frame. And then we can see we've got 20 rows and we've got 3 columns. And here's the output. So 20 articles, right? And with dates, heading, and link. So that's pretty much it for our contents. So I think we'll open for questions. So can you repeat the question for the webinar people?
Yeah, how do you perform a version control for all your scripts you write? Like, do you have access to the GitHub where you
everything? Very good question. So my understanding is that in the technology world, most companies use GitHub. In the corporate world, you know, where most actuaries work, we manually do version control. So basically copy and paste the code and create a new folder with a day stamp. So yeah, anyone else has any idea of how to do it?
I think we have some managed tools to manage the version. So the GitHub will be one example.
The GitHub, yeah. Cool. Yeah, we're actually exploring that.
How much help or assistance have you got from your organization in your journey of the learning? I assume you wouldn't spend 100% of your spare time doing this, right?
No, not quite. probably, I don't know, 50%. We're very lucky to have Bill as our boss. He's very open to the open source technology. So I think last year or maybe 2 years ago, we were starting the journey. So we were assessing the different packages. So we were given the ability to explore that at work. And also soon we were able to find some use applications. So we can demonstrate that there's value in open source tools. And that's when we started to get some traction. So I think, Leon, do you have anything to add?
So I started off by telling you the business problem that I had, which was to get an earning pattern for travel insurance. So that for me was a way to get the business's buy-in. Obviously, one way to test my earning pattern, if you earn your premiums in line with risk, then you should get a uniform loss ratio. When using other methods and I didn't get a uniform loss ratio, obviously that tells the business, no, that particular earning pattern that I had derived in Excel was not that good. In predicting, in lining up with the claims. So, yeah, pick a project that you think will deliver commercial value would be my suggestion.
Do you have any tips on like handling large sets of data in like R and Python?
Sorry, the question is.
Do you have some tips on handling like large sets of data in R and Python? Because when I've used R in the past, I've come to like memory limits because of the RAM.
Yeah. So we're struggling with memory as well. it's a big problem. One solution is to ask your boss to buy you more memory. So that's the simple approach. There are other things you can do, like I was exploring big data formats like Spark, so PySpark, and you can store your data in Parquet format, and that you can store that in your hard drive, and it can handle huge data sets, like terabytes of data. We're just exploring that. So, sorry, other than buying memory, you can also go to the cloud. You can rent some PC, cloud server at a very cheap rate, pay for what you need to use, and then, hopefully you can overcome that.
Zem wasn't joking. We went to MSY to buy RAM. It's cheap.
May I add something about the capacity problem? I think cloud is a very good option, but currently some company maybe they are not familiar with it, so the management team haven't decided to go for that. Yeah, definitely that's a very good option in the future. So except of the cloud option, maybe you can try H2O in R, will give you more memory because they use your whole PC core to run.
I'll just jump in with a couple from online here. So I'll read the first one out. A Caltech professor once said, the difference between an amateur and a pro in machine learning is the ability to regularize. He said something along the lines that anyone can fit. The difference is how to avoid overfitting. What are some techniques you use to avoid overfitting?
Yes, so overfitting, if you think about it, it's very easy to run your model, and you see some pattern there, it may not be real. So there's a set of techniques in machine learning. So we basically split the data into different subsets. So you run your model on, say, 90% of the data, and then test it on the 10%, and just to confirm the performance of your model. So that's called out-of-sample testing. And then you can rotate that. You pick a different 90% and then build a model and test on the different 10%. Keep on doing that, and you can get a true sense of performance for the model. So I think traditionally you don't do that much, but in the machine learning model, that's extremely important.
Just to add to that point of overfitting, I think there might be a way that you can split your data into three subsets. So there's a training set, there's a test set, and there's a hidden set. I think that's what cargo competition do, is there's a hidden set that you use to actually test the algorithm. So because if you keep using the test set to see how good your model is fitting the data, you will get a really good data for the test set. But when you then test that model with the hidden data set, if the fitting is not very good, then you might be overfitting. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So what we do is, we actually leave a portion of our data that we never touch it. Yeah. We just use the rest to build our model. But in the subset that we use to build a model, we actually cut into 90-10 and rotate. So that's called cross-validation. I think also there's a time dimension as well. So if typically in insurance, right, you would say you are modeling claims, a good thing to do is to leave out the very last bit of time period out. So rather than randomly sample it, just cut out the very, in terms of time dimension, leave that bit of data out. That gives you a more realistic assessment of the model performance.
I've got one more from online, and then we might have time for a couple more. A question on optimizing R code. I used R back at university to build a Monte Carlo model to pricing interest rates derivatives from scratch. It turned out to be a bad idea, as it took me 7 days to generate what would take C++ 1 second. I worked out later I wasn't getting the same performance as the free R package, as those packages were actually written in Fortran, a lower level language. Have you experienced similar performance issues, and how did you overcome it?
I think a lot of the packages we use actually written in low-level languages. So like if you use R, below that is actually Fortran, so it's already optimized. So I think with modern language, either Python or R, you have this interface where you can code, but below under the hood, you got low level like C++ or Fortran doing the hard work. So I think that's okay. Yeah.
Sometimes I cheat. I do go back to SAS when I just completely give up.
In terms of your work with non-technical people, have you found it challenging with managing expectations? Because when we've worked with some people around predictive modeling or machine learning, we found that people expect it to be a magic box and predict everything. So have you found expectation management is a challenge?
Yeah, I found when using Tableau, it almost looks too good to be true, as in the way that it just makes data and your exhibits look so professionally formatted. You do have to kind of take a step back. You have to make sure that it's simple enough for other people to challenge as well and not just blindly accept. I find also that when I've presented things with snippets of R in there and plots coming out of R, that also puts people off. You really have to just get to know your audience. Some people, they are naturally kind of, they don't buy in as much when they see something formatted up in R than they do in Tableau. It's really hard with technical people that we've presented to. They trust exactly what you've done in R because they know the workflow there. They know what reconciliation points you've put in. That's a hard one to answer, Mark. Sorry, but just have to know the audience. Yeah.
So I might just add. Yeah. So managing expectations is a huge problem. So we as actuaries or data scientists, we might be obsessed with different technologies and different, but management honestly don't care too much about the technical detail. All they care about is the result. So the key challenge is how do you interpret your model and then present it so that it's perceived to be adding a lot of value. So one example is risk modeling. I know I can build the same risk model using machine learning very quickly, but in reality, people are still used to GLMs. So it gives you a nice relativity table. So you can say, okay, 60-year-olds are twice as risky as 30-year-olds, whereas you can't say that in machine learning. So that's where you might need to make a compromise. So instead of using machine learning, you might go back to GLM because that's the only model that's accepted by the industry at this stage. But say in 10, 20 years, as new people come up and they're very familiar with machine learning or even deep learning, I think that's when the power of the machine learning will take off.
Just a quick time check because we've passed two. Looks like this Arsenal match has gone into extra time. But we're happy to stay on if you've got questions. We still have about 100 on the webinar as well. So if you're happy to continue, that's fine. But if you've got somewhere to be, don't feel bad. So feel free to stay on or go. Thank you.